I think I'm going to go ahead and start, guys, just because of the volume of material tonight. But if you want to, if you missed the first part and want to catch it, you can always go back and listen to it. So for the next four lessons, we're going to be discussing the geologic column in the fossil record. And this is where we really get into the crux of the history of the Earth and where evolution must be proved. First, let's back up and do a little review. Number one, and so what we're doing is giving lots of material, and some people have said, this is so much material, I can't remember it all. Well, that's fine. What we're really trying to do is just get you to understand some of the major principles involved in this issue. So number one, explain the positive and negative principle or principles regarding evolutionary change in animal kinds. Can anyone do that? Animals can evolve or change within their own kind, which is called microevolution, but they cannot change outside their kinds. Number two, why is Darwinian evolution not truly a scientific theory? Right. It cannot be tested with a scientific method. It is not falsifiable. And number three, this is from last week, so we haven't gone over this as much, but what is the, what I call the fruit fly principle regarding genetic mutations? That is, what are the three criteria necessary for a mutation to effect or cause Darwinian evolution? Can anyone remember these? It has to be beneficial, number one. Number two, it has to be structural. And number three, it has to be persistent or passed down. So morphologically beneficial mutations that are passed down. So now tonight, these are the four things we're going to look at tonight. Number one, Darwinian evolution must be proved from the fossil record or the hypothesis fails. Number two, animals do not change throughout the fossil record. That is, stasis prevails. Animals remain the same. Number three, animals appear fully formed from the earliest layers of the geologic column. This is what we're going to call the Cambrian explosion, or what scientists have called. And number four, as a creationists and biblical scholars, we believe the fossil record represents a worldwide flood sedimentation based on the great deluge during Noah's day. So as we study geology and the fossils for the next 4 weeks, let's start out with some definitions to make sure we're all on the same page. Number one definition, what is geology? Geology is the study of the history of the earth preserved in the rock record. Number two, what is the geologic column? The geologic column is the sum total of all the sedimentary layers within the earth's crust. Number three, these layers are called strata. What is strata? Strata are the parallel layers of rock deposited in what we call superposition. I say we, what the geologists call superposition in the geologic column. And from that, they have the law of superposition. The law of superposition says this. It simply says if a layer is underneath another layer, it is older. Now, whether it is 11 months older, say it was created during the flood of Noah's day, or whether it's 1.5 billion years older, according to the evolutionists, it doesn't say. But simply, the law of superposition says the lower a layer is, generally speaking, the older it is. There are some exceptions to that during geologic processes that upturn and up in certain layers. Number four, the study of strata is called stratigraphy. This is the branch of geology that studies, that classifies, that interprets, and dates the strata found in the geologic column. You see a couple examples here. Here on the right is in the Mediterranean, they're studying the strata. And on the left here, you can see this hill represents millions of years of strata, correct? No, this was all created in 1 week. This is the result of Mount St. Helens eruption in 1980. And number five, paleontology. What is paleontology? Paleontology is the study of the history of life as preserved in the fossils of the geologic column. So you have geology that studies the rocks. Paleontology studies the life in the rocks. Stratigraphy studies the layers within the geologic column. So now let's go back and ask the question, what is evolution? Darwinian evolution teaches that all life evolved from one single-celled organism, microbe to man, over 3.8 billion years. But we want to point this out. If Darwinism is true, it must clearly be demonstrated from the fossil record, or the hypothesis fails. If evolution really occurred over 3.8 billion year period, we should find it in the fossil record, correct? Let's go to six quotes, and I want you to get these quotes down because, for a very important reason. Have you ever studied with someone and you know the arguments they're going to make? I know Jeff's done this. And you know that once you get them to a point of seeing the truth, they may start to hedge and they may change their argument. So what I do in some of these conversations, in the very beginning, we lay the groundwork and we say, okay, you believe this? Okay, let's write this down. And we write down what they believe, so when later in the conversation, they can't say, well, I never believed that in the first place. You can turn the paper around and say, no, here you said you believed it. We're going to do that with six quotes here. Because what's going to happen is once we undermine the validity of the evolutionary hypothesis in the geologic layer, you know what the evolutionists are going to do? They're going to come back and say, well, we never believed you could prove evolution in the fossils in the first place. So here are the quotes. Number one, Charles Darwin in 1872, in I believe the second edition of The Origin of Species, said the number of intermediate and transitional links between all living and extinct species must have been inconceivably great. Now he said, we haven't found them, but they must have been great because we know evolution took place. Notice this. This is from a professor at the University of Southampton, Dr. Gerald Kirkut. He said the most important evidence for the theory of evolution is what? That obtained from the fossils or paleontology. He says the main factual basis for the modern view of evolution is the fossils. Here's Austin Clark. He was at Smithsonian. He said that evolution actually did occur can only be scientifically established from what? The discovery of fossilized remains. Quote number four. Here is Carl Dunbar, professor at Yale University. He said, fossils provide the only historical documentary evidence that life has evolved from simpler to more and more complex forms. If evolution is going to be proved true, it has to be in the fossils. Quote number five. This is from Pierre-Paul Grasset. He was past president of the French Academy of Sciences. He says, evolution is revealed only through fossil forms. Only paleontology can provide them with the evidence of evolution. We have to see it in the fossils. Finally, quote number six is from Stephen Stanley. He graduated from Yale. He taught at Johns Hopkins. And now that he's retired, he actually took another job. It's a tough job, but someone has to do it. He's professor emeritus at the University of Hawaii. See him there in his shirt. So notice what Stanley says. In the absence of the fossil record, the credibility of evolutionists would be severely weakened. We might wonder whether the doctrine of evolution would qualify as anything more than an outrageous hypothesis. He says if we don't find evolution in the fossils, then evolution is nothing more than an outrageous hypothesis. We would agree. But what we're going to do is continue to do what we did last time. We're conducting a model comparison. On the one side, we have the creation model. On the other side, we have the evolution model. Let's look at the evidence and see which evidence best predicts the models. So we have the two models, the Darwinian model that says microbe to man, the creation model that said all life suddenly appeared during the 6 days of creation on Earth. Let's outline some of the principles here. The Darwinian model predicts, we're going to show two things the Darwinian model predicts. Number one, Darwin predicts that the simplest life forms at the bottom of the geologic column would gradually evolve and become more complex and diverse. That is, there would be fewer animals and life forms at the bottom, and at the very top, there would be a great amount of diversity over millions of years. Number two, the Darwinists also predict that between all these animal kinds that you see here, there must be millions and millions of intermediate links. We call these transitional fossils. You'll know them in the popular press as missing links. You know, they've looked for them for 150 years. I don't know why they're still called missing links if evolution is a fact. They must be found in the geologic column. Now let's look at the biblical creation model. If the Bible is true, what will we expect to find in the geologic column? Three things. I'm going to point out three things here. Number one, all life form suddenly appears on the earth, fully formed in an explosion of highly diverse life on the bottom of the geologic column. If the Bible is true, you should be able to dig down into the geologic column, and at the bottom, you should be able to find just a vast explosion of animals that appeared. After the earth was created, we know it went on for a while, a couple thousand years, and then the flood occurred. So we should find those. Number two, the biblical creation model predicts millions of transitional fossils between animals would not occur. Animals would appear as distinct kinds in fixed categories. Now, look at this example here. I think we have time to look at it. This is actually a diagram from the magazine Scientific American. In this magazine, they showed the dinosaur family tree, and they showed 27 animal groups here within the dinosaur family tree. Birds are in there. You might say, why are birds in there? Well, actually, birds are dinosaurs. They're actually classified in the dinosaur category. They're one of the only categories of animals, of dinosaurs, that are still living. So that's why birds are in the dinosaur family tree. So in here we have 27 different kinds. Now notice here at the bottom, this is where they supposedly branched from other animals, okay? Here's the animal, and here is what it evolved from, the branches, right? Well, notice what the subtitle says here. Tinted areas indicate solid fossil evidence. So where do we have fossils? Only where we see the animals. The branches don't have any fossil evidence. And that's what we're going to see for the rest of the lesson today. Number three, the biblical model also predicts that there would be a succession of fossils. Okay? There would be different fossils as you go up the geologic column. Why would there be a succession of fossils as you go up the geologic column according to the Bible? Well, representing the Noahic flood. This represents different animal habitats. Notice during Noah's flood, as the flood waters ascended, they would have first covered the oceans, then the rivers and streams, then the banks, the marshy areas, the lowland forests, upland forests, and finally at the very top, you would get the animals with the highest intelligence that would have the ability to escape the ascending floodwaters. And we're going to look in some coming weeks at some amazing pictures. In the Grand Canyon, you always find the dinosaur tracks lower than you do the bones. And they're always going uphill. Why is that? Well, I think we can explain it through the creation model. Those dinosaurs were escaping these floodwaters. They washed back and forth across the earth as these tidal waves or tsunamis would cover an area and then recede. So let's look in the scripture. I think the biblical creation model is best represented in 2 Peter 3, 3 through 6. Summarizes it here. Notice what Peter says. Knowing this first of all, of first importance, some versions say, and the ESV, NASB, and I think NIV have very good renderings of this verse. You're going to notice your New King James Version or King James Version is not going to use quite as descriptive language of points number one and two as we're going to see here in a minute. Peter said, knowing this first of all, that scoffers will come in the last days with scoffing, following their own sinful desires. And what will scoffers say? Where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all things are continuing as they were from the beginning of creation. Who does that sound like? That sounds like the evolutionists and the people that oppose the Bible today. Where is God? Where is Jesus? You know, if there was a worldwide flood, where is the evidence? Well, notice what Peter says. For they deliberately overlooked this fact, that the heavens existed long ago, and I want you to notice two things here. Number one, the earth was formed out of water and through water. Genesis 1 verses 9 and 10 says, God caused the waters to be gathered together into one place and made the dry land appear. So first you had the earth covered with water. And then in Genesis 1, 9 and 10, God gathered the waters in one place and shoved the earth up through the waters. Number two, and that by means of these, the waters, the world that was then existed was deluged with water and perished. So the evolutionists forget that, you know, the Bible suggests there could have been a worldwide flood. They don't even consider a worldwide flood. That was mocked and criticized and laughed at since the late 18th century in the 1700s. Well, guess what they're saying today? They're finally admitting, well, catastrophic processes may have occurred, but it was a series of 7 or 8 or up to 15 floods around the world. But they weren't worldwide floods. It wasn't a single flood. Well, notice how Darwinian evolutionists interpret the geologic column. Notice here, when you look through the layers of the geologic column, you have 13 different periods. These 13 periods begin at the bottom with the Precambrian period and go up to the very top in the period we're in now, the Quaternary period. They say this represents up to 600 million years of time, about 530 or 550, actually, when the Cambrian started. However, I want you to think about this. There are some problems with this. Number one, although there are 13 geological periods, these periods were supposed to cover up to 130 miles. If you put all these periods together, they would be 130 miles deep. Do you see any place on Earth where there's 130 miles of sediment? No, they say some eroded. We do not find any one place on Earth where there is 130 miles of sediment. Number two, although these 13 periods represent 130 miles, we only see an average of 1.5 miles of sediment anywhere on Earth. It ranges from 0 to 5 miles of sediment anywhere on Earth. Number three, one of the only places on Earth where you can see many of these strata in one location on top of each other is the Grand Canyon. And yet, it's only 4,000 feet deep, or roughly a little less than a mile. However, did you know the Grand Canyon, out of the 13 periods, only has 5 of the 13 periods? There's no place on Earth where you can go and see these periods. Then how did they come up with 13 periods? Well, they took different strata from around the world, and they kind of make a picture that we really don't see anywhere in the world. So next, how do geologists and paleontologists know the world is 4.5 billion years old? How do they know the geologic strata all the way down to the Precambrian represents 1 billion years of history? This is very important. If you get this. Not by empirical science. Do you remember how we stress the scientific method? You see an observation, develop a hypothesis, devise an experiment, and conduct repeated experiments. That's science. That's the scientific hypothesis that was first developed by Bacon in the 18th century or 17th century. Did you know that paleontology, archaeology, geology is not empirical science? Why? Because no one was there. If they were, they're dead. There is no living person that has been there to see in the past how these rocks developed. And no rock has a date on it. No bone has a date on it. It is not empirically testable. So, number two, geologists and paleontologists must do this. Get this. They must construct historical narratives or, quote, tentative scenarios to explain or devise explanations and stories to explain what they've seen. Now, if they're devising stories, historical narratives and tentative scenarios, it's going to be influenced by their personal biases and presuppositions, isn't it? That is, as Andrew Snelling likes to say, they impose their beliefs on the rocks. They have a preconceived idea about how the earth was formed and evolved, and they impose that on the rocks and not vice versa. And we'll point that out here from the evolutionists themselves. Tonight, I'm only quoting from evolutionists. There's no one up here that does not believe in evolution, okay? All these people do. This first quote I actually got from Don Patton. The man you see on the screen is Jack Horner. This is the man who was modeled, the Jurassic Park movie was modeled after him, okay? As he goes out in paleontologists digging up bones. Jack Horner is the one that discovered the dinosaur called the Mosasaurus. He was also the technical director for all three Jurassic Park movies. He wrote the book Dinosaur Lives in 1997, and notice what he says. Paleontology is a historical science based on circumstantial evidence after the fact. We can never reach hard and fast conclusions. These days, it's easy to go through school without ever hearing that some sciences are historical or by nature inconclusive. That is, you can't just go out and run an experiment and prove whether or not, you know, these animals evolved from one another. Also, let's look at how the historical science is subject to presupposition. Here, Dr. David Kitts explains this. He was at the University of Oklahoma. He says an examination of the work of those paleontologists, and I'm skipping through some of these quotes, but I'm going to put all these online, all in context, reveals the fact that the record of evolution, like any other historical record, must be construed within a complex of what? Preconceptions. Well, what are the preconceptions? If you want to go to university today and become a paleontologist, what preconceptions must you have? Notice what he says. Not the least of which is the hypothesis that evolution has occurred. In other words, if you want to go to the university and study paleontology to find out if evolution occurred, you have to come in with a presupposition that evolution occurred in the first place. Stephen Jay Gould, who's a paleontologist at Harvard University, said, "Our ways of learning about the world are strongly influenced by social preconceptions and biased modes of thinking. The stereotype of a fully rational and objective scientific method with individual scientists as logical robots is a self-serving mythology." Here's a guy for about 30 years who disputed many of the common paleontological standards in the evolutionary community. Notice this next quote from Dr. Tom Kemp. He's at Oxford University, Department of Zoology, curator of the zoological collections. He says, "Of course there are many gaps in the fossil record, with intermediate forms almost unknown. That is, we don't find the transitional forms." Notice this. "However, the known groups, that is the groups that we know, have enough features in common. How are they going to explain the transitions? That it is possible to reconstruct a hypothetical intermediate stage." In other words, he says, when you go to the fossils, you don't find these transitions. But he says, we know enough about the two different kinds of animals that we can construct a hypothetical transition, because we know evolution must have occurred. Notice Gareth Nelson, who was at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. He said, "It is a mistake to believe that even one fossil species or fossil group can be demonstrated to have been ancestral to one another. That a known fossil is an actual ancestor of some other species or group is an assumption scientifically just unjustifiable." In other words, just because you find different animals in the ground, you can't prove that one is the ancestor of the other. How can you prove that? Again, Tom Kemp says, "In no single adequately documented case is it possible to trace a transition species by species from one genus to the other." This is not what you hear in the textbooks today. So point number two, animals do not change in the fossil record. That is, stasis prevails. What is stasis? Stasis is the state of staying the same. Do we stay in stasis throughout our lives? No, we change. Well, what he's saying is these animal kinds, we're going to see these animal kinds change. So my question is, where are the transitional fossils? Where are these missing links? I believe this is one of the strongest, if not the strongest, evidence for overturning the idea of evolution. I really believe it's the Achilles heel of Darwin, the lack of transitional fossils in the fossil record. Notice, even Darwin thought this. In 1872, Origin of Species, he said, "Why is not every geologic formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? This is the most obvious and serious objection which can be urged against the theory." He said, "We know evolution is true, but we don't find the transitions in the fossil record." Well, what did Darwin predict? He predicted that in the coming years, they would find more fossils and they would be able to fill in all these missing gaps. Has that been the case? Has that occurred? Let's see what Dr. David Ropp says. He was the curator of the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago, also paleontologist at University of Chicago. He said, "In the years after Darwin, his advocates hoped to find predictable progressions." That is, they thought they were going to find these transitions. "Yet the optimism has died hard, and some pure fantasy has crept into textbooks." Does that sound like what the other quote said? People had to make up hypothetical examples of transitions. He goes on to say here in another article, "The record of evolution is still surprisingly jerky. And ironically," notice this, "we have fewer examples of evolutionary transition than we did in Darwin's time." And how many did Darwin have? None. Are you starting to see a pattern here? So the question is, will they find the transitions in time? Do they just need more time? Do they just need to dig a little more, find some more fossils? Well, notice Gareth Nelson again at the American Museum of Natural History. He says, the history of comparative biology teaches us that the search for ancestors is doomed to ultimate failure. He says, we're not going to find them if we dig. Therefore, a more complete sample of the fossil record, he says, even if we dig more, in itself, would only complicate the problem. How would it complicate the problem if they dig up more fossils? Well, because the more they dig, the more it represents the creationist model. The more we see animals in separate, distinct groups, we don't see the transitions. David Kitts, again, from University of Oklahoma, said that despite the bright promise that paleontology provides, it has presented some nasty difficulties for evolutionists, the most notorious of which is the presence of gaps in the fossil record. Evolution requires intermediate forms between species, and paleontology does not provide them. George Gaylord Simpson says the regular absence of transitional forms is not confined to mammals, but is almost a universal phenomenon. Gould, again, at Harvard, says the absence of fossil evidence for intermediary stages between major transitions has been a persistent and nagging problem for evolution. He calls it the most puzzling fact of the fossil record. So here is, you know, the premier paleontologist, expert on evolution in the United States, and he says the most puzzling fact about evolution is the fossil record. Now, which model does that better represent? This is, if you study this whole issue, this is going to surface as one of the most famous quotes. Colin Patterson was arguably one of the top 10 paleontologists in the whole world at the time, in the 70s and 80s. He was curator at the British Museum of Natural History. Okay, so he had enough clout to say what he wanted to say without risking his career. And he was close to the end of his career anyway, so he didn't care. So he went around the world and started, you know, there's numerous quotes where he says, everything we've been taught is wrong. Anyway, he wrote a book on evolution. He believes in evolution. He doesn't doubt it. But he didn't list any transitions in the book. And so a man by the name of L.D. Sunderland wrote to him. You can find this on the internet. It's very well known, very popular, frequently used. And L.D. Sunderland said, Dr. Patterson, why didn't you include any transitions in your book? Where are the intermediate species? Listen to what Patterson says. I fully agree with your comments about the lack of evolutionary transitions in my book. If I knew of any, fossil or living, I would have certainly included them. Gould and the American Museum people are hard to contradict when they say there are no transitional fossils. I will lay it on the line. There is not one such fossil for which one could make a watertight argument. And you might be saying, well, if Gould doesn't believe there's transitions, if all these guys, Patterson doesn't believe these transitions, where are they going to go? Well, we're going to talk about that next week. They come up with an alternate idea for evolution. Okay, a different idea. We'll talk about that next week because they don't doubt evolution. They just say it has to be explained differently. Notice Gould goes on to say the extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as what? The trade secret of paleontology. Leif, what if everyone knew everything that you're learning about diesel mechanics? Well, that would make your job obsolete. In other words, it's almost like a trade secret. You have the knowledge, so you can perform the tasks, because everyone else doesn't have the knowledge. Well, what he's saying is, what everyone doesn't know about paleontology, the trade secret is that we don't find the transitions in the fossil record. The high school teachers don't talk about that. The undergrads in college aren't taught that. None of the students are taught that. He says the evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks, notice this, have data only at the tips and nodes of the branches. The rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of the fossil. What does he mean, only evidence at the tips and nodes? What he's saying is there's no branching evidence. We only have evidence here. So this is what the creationist would believe we would see in the fossil column. We see animals dispersed throughout the fossil column without the connecting branches. Gould says they appear in the fossil column at the node and they disappear at the tip. And this is what we would expect to see as creationists. Why? As the animals escape the ascending floodwaters in the great flood, they would begin being destroyed until finally they were extinct. In fact, 98% of all species that have ever lived are gone. They're extinct. Gould goes on to say, most species exhibit no directional change during their tenure on Earth. They appear in the fossil record looking much the same as when they disappeared. Now, his colleague who he worked a lot with, Niles Eldridge, he was at the American Museum of Natural History and I think Columbia University. Eldridge says, paleontologists have been insisting that their record is consistent with slow, steady, gradual evolution. He says they've known for over 100 years that such is not the case. Stephen Stanley again says, the known fossil record fails to document a single example of phyletic morphological transition and hence offers no evidence that the gradualistic model can be valid. I believe there's one more quote here. David Woodruff from UC San Diego, he said, but fossil species remain what? Unchanged throughout most of their history, and the record fails to contain a single example of significant transition. So now let's start looking at the different animals. We're told that plants evolved, right? Well, how did plants evolve from aquatic or water plants in the water to terrestrial or land plants? Well, here, let's hear from the experts. Here are two professors, Gensel and Andrews, paleobotanists. That sounds exciting. So they go through the fossil record and they try to find out how the plants evolved. And notice what they say. We still lack any precise information concerning the presumed aquatic ancestors from which land plants evolved. The search for evidence of probable transitional stages continues. We're still looking for them. But this is what we see in textbooks. Plants evolved from aquatic to land plants. Well, what about evolutionary appearance of fish? Have you ever seen pictures like this in textbooks? So they say that, well, all the fish evolved from one another here. But what did the fish evolve from? If you look on the internet, you're going to be hard-pressed to even find any diagrams. Where did the fish come from? We don't know where they came from. Notice what Gerald Todd from UCLA says. All three subdivisions of bony fish first appear in the fossil record at approximately the same time. Why is there no trace of earlier intermediate forms? Why? Can anyone explain that? I think we can. Why? Because the fish were covered up in the sediment during the flood. Notice F.D. Ominy. He wrote the book The Fishes in Life for the Life Nature Library series. He says that how the earliest chordate stock evolved to give rise to true fish-like creatures, we do not know. We have no idea where fish came from. Well, what about fish evolving to amphibians? We're told that fish gradually changed to amphibians, such as the picture you see here. By the way, your tax dollars paid for this picture. This is a PBS shot here. So PBS used this to teach the public that we evolved from fish and amphibians. But notice what the experts of amphibian and fish evolution. This is Drs. Hobson and Radinsky from University of Chicago. They say no clear intermediate form in the fish tetrapod. Tetrapod is having four limbs for walking. Transition has ever been discovered. We've never discovered it. Well, what about the appearance of amphibians on land? What about salamanders and frogs? What did they evolve from? Well, here's another professor at McGill University, Robert Carroll. He says in the absence of fossil evidence of frogs and salamanders, he said, we don't have any evidence of where they evolved from. Then how do they determine they evolved? Notice this. Evolved from a close common ancestor, we must consider the possibility that each of the modern orders evolved from a distinct group of Paleozoic amphibians. They don't have it in the fossil record. They have to interpolate. Well, what about amphibian evolving into reptiles? That has to be true, doesn't it? Aren't we all taught that amphibians evolved into reptiles? Lewis Carroll says, unfortunately, not a single specimen of an appropriate reptilian ancestor is known prior to the appearance of true reptiles. They're saying when we look in the fossil record, boom, we see reptiles. But we don't see a transition between the amphibians and reptiles. But they assume it must have occurred. Well, and this leads to another interesting fact with regard to supposed reptile evolution. What about the snakes? You know, you've seen in your high school and college textbooks the diagrams of how all the snakes evolved, right? No! You know, if you look on the internet, you can't even find anything about snake evolution on the internet. No, it's very difficult as far as to even find pictures. Why? They don't have any idea. Snakes just appear in the fossil record. You know, the closest I could find in a comparison to show evolution of snakes from amphibians was this right here. This is the best they could do. So they took a salamander and put him next to, I'm not exactly sure what this is. It may be a legless lizard. You know, sometimes you think they're snakes, but they're actually legless lizards. So, and if you go on the internet here, this was used as an example to show that, well, you see, snakes evolved from salamanders. Why? Because they look so similar. Well, then we should be able to find it in the fossil record, right? Well, notice here are the experts, Drs. Colbert and Morales. Colbert was paleontologist, professor at Columbia University. He's also responsible for naming the Staurikosaurus. He says, unfortunately, the fossil history of snakes is very fragmentary. Well, Dr. Colbert, then how do you decide how snakes evolve? Here's how. Listen to this. It is necessary to infer much of their evolution from the what? Comparative anatomy of modern forms. He says, we don't find it in the record, so the only way we can prove it is to line up a salamander and a legless lizard here and say, see, they look so much alike. But what do you know from our previous lectures? Do similarities always indicate evolutionary relationship? Not according to Darwinists. Why? Our eye is almost identical to the octopus eye. And yet they say, no, we didn't evolve from the same line. Well, what about the evolutionary appearance of primates? Where did primates come from? Notice Robert Carroll at McGill. He says, no specific derived characteristics have been demonstrated as being uniquely shared between early primates and the early member of any other order. We don't see the similarities. Where did the primates come from? They don't know. What about the appearance of insects? If you really want to get an evolutionist in interesting conversation, ask them how insects evolve. And what do we find in the fossil record? When you look down the fossil record, you can look back to the Cambrian, and the insects there look identical to the insects today. Except some of them were much bigger, like 27-inch wide wingspans on dragonflies. Well, notice what Grasse says. He says, we are in the dark concerning the origin of insects. You've all seen the charts of insect evolution in textbooks? No, they don't have any idea. Niles Eldridge said, if ever there was a myth, it is that evolution is a process of constant change. So the last thing we're going to look at today is point number 4, the Cambrian explosion. So remember we said that if the creation model is true, we should see a great explosion of all the different kinds of animals all the way at the bottom of the fossil column, right? That's what we see. Every major phyla appears at the bottom of the fossil column in the Cambrian layer. That is in the first 2%. The first 2% of the fossil layer, you get all 100 phyla that have ever existed. In fact, there were 100 in the Cambrian layer. Today, there's only 36 left. They've disappeared. They've become extinct. So the Darwinian interpretation says we go from simple to complex, right? No, that's not what we see. We don't see gradual evolution up the fossil column. You know, they would suggest that evolution occurs something like this. This is called the cone of diversity. That evolution gradually occurred according to branching patterns And yet we see this spindle broken pattern where animals just appear in the fossil column, but they're not connected by transitions. But do you know what we just, what did we just say with regard to the Cambrian explosion? If all animals appeared at the bottom, and yet there's fewer of them today, then is this a correct representation? No. This shows more diversity at the top. But what do we see in the fossil column? More diversity at the bottom. If you want to represent this more accurately, you're going to have to turn it on its head. It's going to have to look like this. You're going to have more diversity at the bottom with extinction and decimation as you go to the top. In fact, Stephen Jay Gould from Harvard even recognized this. And he said the Darwinian model does not fit. We do not see this cone of diversity. He says what we do see, he has suggested something called decimation and diversification. He says at the very bottom, we have all the different animals that exploded in the Cambrian explosion. We don't know where they came from, they just evolved very rapidly. Now, which model looks more credible? Well, if I wanted to believe in evolution, I certainly wouldn't believe in this one. That in a very short period of time, millions of animals evolve all of a sudden. Well, that doesn't make any sense according to Gould's model. And he says the Darwinian model doesn't work. You know what? The creation model fits perfectly. And it looks very similar to Gould's model, except the creation model does not have the branches at the bottom, which Gould assumes and can't prove anyway. This is what the creation model looks like. If you cut off these branches at the bottom, it should look like this. That's what the creation model predicts, and that's exactly what you see in the fossil record. Great diversity at the bottom of the fossil column, and as you go up toward the top, you get decimation and extinction. And so we're told that all these 11 different phyla, you see this graph here, they say it slowly evolved over time, right? All these 9 different phyla here, did they evolve over millions of years? No, they appeared all at once at the very bottom of the fossil column. Therefore, everything we're taught in school has been incorrect. Things didn't gradually evolve. They appeared all at once in the Cambrian layer at the bottom. So the question is, where are the Precambrian ancestors? If all these animals appeared at once in the Cambrian, where are the ones that came before? Roger Lewin, who was a news editor for Science, said, the Cambrian explosion, notice this, established virtually all the major animal body forms, that is the phyla or balplana, that would exist thereafter. Here's 3 well-known paleontologists. They are respectively Irwin, Valentine, and Jablonski at the Smithsonian, Berkeley, and University of Chicago. They say all of the basic architectures of animals were apparently established, quote, established by the close of the Cambrian explosion. And over the past 600 million years, we haven't had any more. Does that seem a little odd that all animal body types evolved all at once, and then over the past 600 million years, no more have evolved? Stephen Bingston said, if any event in life's history resembles man's creation myths, it's the diversification of marine life. He said, I don't believe in the creation myth, but if there is, you know, anything that looks like it in nature, it's this great diversification. Gould goes on to say, the problem of the Cambrian explosion has not receded, since we have failed to identify a plausible immediate ancestor for the Cambrian faunas. He says, where then are all the Precambrian ancestors? How did modern complexity get off to such a fast start? I think we could explain that, couldn't we, Art? How did modern complexity get off to such a fast start? According to the creation model, according to Genesis 1. Where are all the Precambrian ancestors? Do you know the answer to this mystery, this puzzle? The Precambrian ancestors didn't exist. The only thing we find in the Precambrian are some microorganisms, some bacteria, as well as some algae called stromatolites. This would represent the pre-flood world. This is actually composed of what is called crystalline basement granite rock. This would be the rock that God created and established at the beginning of the world. And thus there would be probably some bacteria and algae living in it before the flood. But after the flood, it would be covered over by the Cambrian layer, which would have all of the animals in it. H.S. Ladd from UCLA said, notice this, most paleontologists today give little thought to rocks older than the Cambrian. He says, ignoring the most important missing link of all. The missing Precambrian record cannot properly be described as a link. You know why? He says, you know, they say we're missing that link, the Precambrian. He says it's not a link. Do you know what it is? He says, in reality, it is about 9/10 of the chain of life. The first 9/10. Why? Because they say in the Precambrian, life began evolving 3.8 billion years ago. It then continued to evolve for 3.2 billion years until the Cambrian. And then all of a sudden, all these animals appeared. Let's move rapidly through some of these. We'll go through, there's more quotes on here that you can find on the internet. I'm going to skip on, not the internet, but I will put these up on the website. I wish I could read all these to you. Some of these are just incredible. But here's the last thing we want to point out. Do you remember at the beginning when we showed these quotes and I said, don't forget this. Don't forget when the evolutionists say you can only prove evolution in the fossil record. Let's read one more time. Stephen Stanley, who's now at Hawaii, said, in the absence of fossil record, the credibility of evolutionists would be severely weakened. We might wonder whether the doctrine of evolution would qualify as anything more than an outrageous hypothesis. Well, we've shown tonight from the evolutionist's mouth that it is an outrageous hypothesis. We don't find evolution in the fossil record. But do you know what they do? They do the old bait and switch. You remember when Lucy used to hold the football out and said, come on, Chuck. Come on, Charlie Brown. Kick the football. And he would run and get ready to kick it, and right before he kicked it, she would yank it out from under him. That's exactly what we see in this controversy. When you talk to people, what do they say proves evolution? The fossil record, the fossil record, the fossil record. But I would challenge you, if you start discussing this with someone, and you press them on these points, you get them to see these quotes, do you know what they're eventually going to do? They're going to take that football and yank it right out. They're going to say, well, the fossil record never really mattered in the first place. Notice these quotes. Here's the first bait and switch. Pierre-Paul Grasse says, well, since paleontology does not shed any light on the genesis of the phyla, one must have recourse to the data drawn from comparative anatomy and embryology. You wonder why they push the embryos so hard? Because there's no proof in the fossil record. They go back to the embryos. Notice what Mark Ridley says. His quotes are just incredible. He says, in any case, no real evolutionist uses the fossil record as evidence in favor of the theory of evolution as opposed to special creation. They don't? They don't? Is that not what the whole theory of evolution is based on? Is the fossil record? Kitts does the old bait and switch and says, if the creationists want to impress the Darwinian establishment, so if we want to impress the Darwinian establishment, he says, it will be no use prating on about what the fossils say. No good Darwinian's belief in evolution stands on the fossil evidence for gradual evolution. David Kitt says, few paleontologists have, I think, ever supposed that fossils by themselves provide grounds for the conclusion that evolution has occurred. The fossil record doesn't even provide any evidence in support of Darwinian theory, except in the weak sense that the fossil record is compatible with it, just as it is compatible with other evolutionary theories and revolutionary theories. And he's not trying to be witty there. As we'll see in subsequent lessons, Darwinian evolution has been used by Marx and Engels and Hitler and Stalin for the genocide of millions of people. He says, and special creationist theory, and even ahistorical theories. So now, this is the last slide. This is the last slide. So where do the evolutionists go from here? If you can pin them down and say, you do not see evolution in the fossil record, we can quote from Stanley and Eldridge and Gould and Patterson. Where do they go? They go to this. It's called the doctrine of punctuated equilibrium. or saltational evolution. And that's what we're going to talk about next week. And I'll leave you with this comic, this cartoon. And I think this is what happens when you're dealing with people who don't want to know the truth. The evolutionist here puts his fingers in his ears and says, go ahead, I'm ready. But we shouldn't be surprised. Some people do not want to hear the truth. Some people are not searching. They're out to prove their bias and preconceived presuppositions. But Paul warned us about this through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit in 2 Timothy 4, 3 and 4. He said, for the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, and they shall turn away their ears from the truth and shall be turned aside to fables. Thank you for your attention.